Welcome back to the Florida History Podcast. I'm Carter Krishnire.
And I'm Robert Bucciolato.
Robert, we're going to spend a lot of time in this particular podcast talking about what an inhumane bastard Andrew Jackson was and how aggressive and illegal, actually illegal internationally, under international law, the conquest of Florida was by Jackson and by the United States. But I do think it's important as we start this episode, which is going to be very hard on General Jackson and future President Jackson, that we mention as president, Jackson was really the first Democrat, right? He was the first guy to get elected by popular majorities. We like to eulogize and have this mythology about our founding fathers, our so-called founding fathers in the United States. But those founding fathers were aristocrats. They were elitists. They were not Democrats. We think that they were great Republicans, right, because they founded a republic. But it was a republic for privileged men. It was a republic for landowners. It was a republic for the aristocrats. And as horrible a person as Andrew Jackson is and was, I should say, he did change that. He was the first real Democrat elected president based on the popular myth of him, largely due to this improper and illegal conquest of Florida we're about to talk about. But just wanted to mention that in passing before we get on to really kind of the nasty stuff about Jackson, beginning with the Battle of Negro Fort in East.
Well, you know, and we it should be noted that we took our time coming here to this topic. You know, this is 200 plus episodes of this podcast that we've been doing since 2019, and I think in a lot of respects we've been pretty open with each other that we've been sort of avoiding this topic, just because it's even regardless of his horrible flaws, it's a very difficult balancing act. You know, I think we take serious our respect for history. The whole purpose of this podcast is to not only share with the people of Florida, but to sort of start a dialogue and to kind of have a conversation in a state that is full of, you know, transient people. People come to this state and leave in a few years. You know, so we have a very fluid identity, and so we kind of have tried to sort of show the bedrock that the state has as far as its past. But Andrew Jackson, in a lot of ways, he's the American Oliver Cromwell. And what I mean by that is, he did extraordinary things. He did unprecedented. Well, Trump wishes he was as interesting as Cromwell, but you know, just these really impressive, amazing contributions on one hand to democracy, to advanced citizenship, to the art form of legislation, of holding and manipulating and exercising power. And then on the other hand, you have genocidal rage, you have violence, you have intolerance, you have hatred, you have bloodshed. And it's too much bad to shrug off, and too much accomplishment to ignore. It's a very frustrating position. And you know, Andrew Jackson, really, I think more than any other, certainly more than any other president, but really more than any other American who was ever alive, really represented the good, the bad, and the evil of what is the American identity. Every good, every bad, every almost evil quality that is inherent in Americana, he represented in his one person. He kind of erupted onto the American scene like an unexpected flame. He came out of nowhere. He was involved in Florida for a few years, which we're going to go into. But the impact that he had on Florida, was felt and is still, the ripples are still going on. Despite the fact that, you know, he wasn't here for a very long period of time. I mean, you look at some of the other figures that we've talked about, you know, on this show, you know, somebody like Bob Graham, who, you know, was in Florida government for 40 years. You compare, his impact on Florida with somebody like Andrew Jackson, who was governor of Florida, territorial governor for a few months, yet the impact was so strong because, when Jackson was coming into his own, when Jacksonian principles were coming into their own, was when Florida was entering statehood, when it was a territory and then it became a state. And the two got interspersed with one another. They got entangled in one another. And the identity of both of them became eternally linked for a very, very long time. And I think we, those of us that are from Florida, I think it's something that we kind of have to grapple with, in much the same way that people have had to grapple with the identity of and the accuracy of the Christopher Columbus fable. You know, something that was, people forget, you know, Columbus was, the 1992 anniversary was widely celebrated in the state of Florida. Andrew Jackson, in much the same way, he was widely held and celebrated in classrooms in Florida until about 20 years ago. He was regarded as a folk hero in Florida classrooms. And a lot of what he did was glossed over. And so there's some very interesting and colorful anecdotes, but there's also a lot of tragedy that's interwoven and a lot of abuses. And so it's our goal to...
So today we're really going to get into the heart of Andrew Jackson and the conquest of Florida, at the invasion of Florida, so to speak, which is what it was, by the Americans. Remember, at this point, Florida is essentially sovereign of the United States. Not essentially sovereign, it is. It's a Spanish territory. There is a fair amount of British influence, and obviously Native Americans and runaway slaves, everything we've talked about before. But this is going to... we're going to be chronicling what is an outright conquest, the theft of a territory, in these next few episodes. It's a sad tale of racism and the aggressiveness of slaveholders and the power of the slave economy and the pro-slavery press and the Democratic Party over the United States, the then United States of America. Very, very sad story this will be, but an important passage in Florida history. The fort, which is in what is now Franklin County on the Apalachicola River, was originally built in 1804, and the Apalachicola River had been the boundary between the British colony of East Florida and the British colony of West Florida. The Spanish had moved that boundary to the Suwannee River. So this is now Florida. The fort was refortified and really kind of built to its more impressive state in 1814 by the British. During the War of 1812 and 1814, the conflict that pitted the British
against the United States of America. We've already talked about on this podcast the Patriots War, which was a front of the war in East Florida between the Spanish and American settlers, or American aggressors, really, aspect of this war of 1812, where Spain was allied with Britain. And let's remember, Britain had ceded East and West Florida back to Spain as part of the peace treaty in 1783. However, British influence remained strong in kind of the anarchist state of Spanish Florida from 1783 onward. And Spain aligned with Britain in the Napoleonic Wars and aligned with Britain against the United States in the War of 1812, effectively gave Britain a free hand in Spanish East Florida. In a future episode, we're going to talk about Fort Mosse, which I'm also researching for the book I'm currently writing. And that was the first permanent settlement of African Americans in what is now a free African Americans in what is now the United States. There's so much interesting history in and around St. Augustine that hasn't been told. And Fort Mosse being just outside of at the time, the Spanish settlement of St. Augustine. But let's make our way back to what is now Franklin County, the banks of the Apalachicola River, and the 1800s. So Edward Nichols was the British commander. Sir Edward Nichols was the British commander. He was an officer in the Royal Marines. Nichols was Irish, and obviously after the Act of Union of 1800, which united the kingdoms of Great Britain and Ireland. Ireland had its own parliament, but had been governed by English kings going back even to the 12 and 1300s, depending on which part of Ireland. And obviously, Ireland was more loyal to the crown during the English Revolution, during the Cromwell Revolution. Cromwell, a noted anti-Catholic, right, a Puritan. Anyway, don't want to get too deep into British history. Edward Nichols was an Ulster Protestant, and he was enlisted in the Royal Navy at the age of 11 in 1795, which was before the Act of Union. So we can consider him a British officer. He was a committed abolitionist. This is really important, obviously. And an advocate for Native American rights. He had served in the Napoleonic Wars in the Royal Navy, and then came as a Marine commander to Spanish Florida. He was the leader of the British attempt to recruit local allies on the Southern Front against the United States. So that meant Native Americans and freed African slaves who by and large, supported the British during that conflict. He set up his base at Prospect Bluff, which was on the Apalachicola River, and that was what we now call in the Negro Fort, or what became known as the Negro Fort. He was able to reinforce that fort, as I mentioned earlier. He recruited Black and Native American corps to become Marines, colonial Marines, for the British Marines, and stationed them at this fort. Also important to note that the Creek Indians on the north of the Alabama and Florida, and Alabama and Georgia border with Florida, or the Georgia border with Florida. In fact, we'll get into it in another episode, but what is now coastal Alabama and coastal Mississippi and the Florida parishes of Louisiana were all part of British West Florida and then part of Spanish West Florida until 1810. So that's something to remember, that historically what is now at least the coastal part of Alabama and Mississippi had been governed as part of Florida by both the British and the Spanish previously.
I know we've gone through this in the last few episodes, but it's worth reiterating if you're listening to this podcast as a standalone program, that all of those areas from the Mississippi River, from Baton Rouge eastward, were part of British West Florida. And then when the Spanish assumed control after the Treaty of Paris in 1783, but actually 1784 is when the British moved out, they had control.
We've talked in previous episodes, and I've written fairly extensively on the Florida squeeze, and I'm writing a book now, as I mentioned earlier, about runaway slaves coming to Spanish Florida, coming to British Florida, leaving the southern U.S. And the British encouraged this during the Revolutionary War, right? The slaves fled from the southern colonies and to St. Augustine in East Florida. And obviously, I mentioned Fort Moresay earlier. There's a whole history we're going to go through in another podcast. And we touched on in some of the previous podcasts of runaway slaves from the Carolinas coming to East Florida, what became East Florida in the 1600s and 1700s. This continued into the early 1800s and actually intensified with the independent United States, effectively after the election of Thomas Jefferson in 1800, controlled by slave states, controlled by the South, as it would be for the most part until 1860. And the Seminole Indians' willingness to accept runaway slaves and make them, quote, what we historically have called Black Seminoles. So you have Native Americans and these runaway slaves at this fort, led by Sir Edward Nichols, or later to be Sir Edward Nichols. At the time, he's the commander of British forces. The war ends in 1815. Nichols is recalled to the British Isles, but he intentionally leaves a fully armed fort in the hands of the blacks in particular, not the Native Americans took kind of a secondary role in this, in the hands of the freed African Americans, the freed blacks who had served alongside the British in the War of 1812. This was a reward for their loyalty and their service. And there were Creek allies and Seminole allies. Of course, those of you who know the history of the Seminole tribe know that they broke off the Creeks, right? Moved to Florida. We don't want to get into that today. But so they were there as well. Nichols is recalled to Britain, but his hope as an abolitionist, as a committed abolitionist, as an Irishman, who obviously Irishmen knew prejudice. I just talked about Oliver Cromwell a few minutes ago, was hoping that this could become the defense, right, the bulwark against the expansion of slavery in the neighboring United States. It could become a center of resistance to slavery near the southern border of the United States. It would be a harbor for runaway slaves. The press in the United States in this, the so-called era of good feelings, where you had one party rule, the Democratic Party, which was the pro-slavery party. Let's not forget there wasn't an anti-slavery party until the Republican Party was founded in the 1850s. The Whigs had pro-slavery and anti-slavery elements. The Whigs were not formed until resistance to President Andrew Jackson created the need for an anti-Jacksonian party. And the Whigs actually were quite successful in early statehood times for Florida, something we'll get into in another podcast. I want to do a whole podcast on the Whig Party. I've read extensively on the Whig Party, partly due to my concerns about current contemporary American political parties and what might happen to them, the current Democratic Party and the current Republican Party. The press in the United States is pro-slavery. Papers throughout the South were concerned about this fort that was in Spanish Florida, Spanish West Florida. The Savannah Journal wrote, "It was not to be expected that an establishment so pernicious to the southern states, holding out as part of their population temptations to insubordination, would have been suffered to exist after the close of the war," that being the War of 1812. In In the course of last winter, several states from this neighborhood fled to that fort. Excuse me, several slaves from this neighborhood fled to that fort. Others lately have gone from Tennessee and the Mississippi Territory. How long shall this evil requiring immediate remedy be permitted to exist? Because, of course, to them, slaves were private property. They're no different than pets, than your animals, right? They're no different than your livestock. Probably more like livestock than pets. I mean, I think pets were probably treated better than slaves throughout much of the South. So you're looking at a situation where the Savannah Journal, along with other newspapers in the American South, are urging an attack on this fort with freed African Americans in that is under the sovereignty of another nation, which was Spain at the time. And as I said, obviously the British played a huge role in this. They had been aligned with Spain. They had never really abandoned the idea of using Florida as an outpost against the United States. They had ceded Florida to Spain in 1783, Spain having liberated West Florida with some colonial help, American colonial help from the British. East Florida was not touched. The three attempts that the Continental Army made to invade East Florida were repulsed by British forces. St. Augustine remained a free a city under British rule throughout the Revolutionary War, as we've talked about in a previous podcast, but they had to cede Florida to Spain. However, Spain, because of European politics, Spain pretty quickly becomes aligned with Britain due to the situation in France. And therefore, Florida remains kind of ostensibly under British influence. The Apalachicola River was like a great highway. If you take the whole system, right? The Apalachicola River, there's Lake Seminole, Chattahoochee River runs up what is now the border between Georgia and Alabama. The Apalachicola River represents the separation, as I mentioned, between East and West Florida previously under British rule, and then between the Eastern and Central time zones after the United States took over. And then you have the Flint River that comes out of Lake Seminole and goes towards Albany, Georgia, right? But it goes through southern Georgia. So these represented highways where raiders in Spanish West Florida could raid big plantations. There are a number of big plantations still that you can tour now in southern Georgia, in places like Albany, around Albany, Thomasville, Moultrie, Bainbridge, those sorts of towns, which are all drivable in short day trips from Tallahassee or from Panama City. So, in fact, a number of you can check out those plantations if you're interested, if you live in that part of the state. So when these plantations were raided, you had slaves freed and brought back to Florida. You had then the United States decide in 1816 they were going to build a base themselves on the Flint River to counter these movements. And, of course, you had General Andrew Jackson, the hero of the Battle of Pensacola in 1814, the hero of the Battle of New Orleans in early 1815, a man who did not respect law, a man who...
I think it's really fair to say Andrew Jackson was a lawless individual, a man with no compunction about human life, quite frankly. Even though, as we said in the first podcast of this series, he's a guy who maybe was the first real Democrat in that he was elected by a Democratic majority. That doesn't mean he was a good human being, because he was not.
There's been a lot of talk that we have, in time, changed our opinions of Andrew Jackson. But there was always a contingent that did not respect Andrew Jackson and did not like him. So in fact, I'm going to give you a quote from Thomas Jefferson, because Jefferson and Jackson were always associated together in history because of the Democratic Party, and also because they were both Southerners, they were both slaveholders, they were both defenders of slavery. However, they were very different people. I mean, Jefferson, I think, on any ideological scale, would be put pretty far to the left. If you take the slavery issue out of it, you look at just his view of governance, of democracy, his Enlightenment and idealism views, his views of religion. Andrew Jackson,
I think is the closest facsimile to Donald Trump that we've had in American history previously. And in fact, I would compare Trump quite favorably with Jackson, in my opinion. So here's a quote from Thomas Jefferson about Andrew Jackson. This was when Andrew Jackson was running for president in 1824. "I feel much alarmed at the prospect of seeing General Jackson president. He is one of the most unfit men I know of for such a place. He has had very little respect for laws and constitutions." That's Andrew Jackson. He had no respect for international law. The fact is, West Florida was under the sovereign control of Spain. And in the War of 1812, Spain was aligned with Britain, who the United States had declared war on. Britain had not declared war on the United States, right? The United States declared war on Britain for origins of the conflict that led to the conflicts that led to the War of 1812. Wikipedia, Google. I'm not saying the British were blameless. Certainly the United States had real grievances, but at the same time, they declared war on Britain, thinking Britain was preoccupied in the Napoleonic Wars fighting off France, which they were, which led to a military stalemate for the most part because Britain was stretched. Anyway, Jackson is a dangerous, dangerous guy. He had no regard for law. So Jackson decides he's going to attack this Negro fort. This was the largest instance before the American Civil War in which armed blacks resisted whites who sought to return them to slavery. Really, really significant. And it was the first event in Andrew Jackson's conquest of Florida, which is what it effectively was. General Jackson did not abide by any established rules of war. Much like the Southerners in the Civil War, they viewed Negroes, blacks, as inferior and worthy of slaughter if they could not return them to slavery. So Jackson, on July 27, 1816, used a heated shot against the fort, igniting the powder magazine in the fort and instantly killing 334 people. A few survivors that were able to make their way south, and there were also some free blacks in the surrounding areas that were not at the fort, who then fled southward, as did, and we talked about the Seminole Wars and Andrew Jackson previously, as did the Seminole Indians, right? They began moving south from that area around the Apalachicola River, around what is now Tallahassee, what had been the center of the Apalachee culture, something we're going to talk about on another episode, and the Spanish mission culture, which we're going to get real soon, actually, in the next few weeks on this podcast. So some of the former slaves, the freed slaves, the African Americans made their way south. They ended up at a place called Cape Florida, which is now on the island of Key Biscayne in Biscayne Bay, just east of Miami. Actually, Key Biscayne made very famous by Bebe Rebozo and Richard Nixon many, many years later, right? By that time, Miami is a major metropolitan area. They flee from Cape Florida to Andros Island in the Bahamas, where they found a town called Nicholstown in the Bahamas, named, obviously, for Sir Edward Nichols. The few survivors that were caught were sold back into slavery or executed. Really, really sad story. The anger among the Seminoles for the loss of the fort led directly to the First Seminole War that started in 1817. They were also much weaker without their black allies, having been either killed, decapitated, or sold back into slavery, or had fled to the Bahamas, fled south and then onward to the Bahamas eventually.
So this was a very sad episode in Florida history. Speaks to the racism of the days. The origins of the United States really being as this kind of slaveholding country, this nation. And we talk about this a little bit. And I, as I said, I'm writing a book and it's going to talk extensively about this. But we've talked about this in the previous podcast where many blacks saw the British as the side worth fighting for in the Revolutionary War. And then also almost universally in the War of 1812, same thing with Native Americans in the War of 1812. And St. Augustine being under British control throughout the war in 1812, the Revolutionary War from 1775 to 1783 was a place African-American runaway slaves fled to. It was a very natural place to end up. And it was a place during Spanish rule that it had a history of being St. Augustine, a very cosmopolitan place by North American standards. So anyway, another topic in Florida history, another unfortunate topic. We've covered Rosewood. We're going to cover the Ocoee Massacre soon. We're going to cover Groveland, and we've covered some really terrible things, this being right there among them. Another awful, awful chapter in the history of Florida.
But what's really apparent, Robert, and bringing you back into this conversation, is that for whatever reason, John C. Calhoun, who we think of as the great champion of slavery, historically, the great champion of the South and secession, was the guy who actually, within the cabinet, it's not known until later, wasn't known until Jackson until later, had stood up for Spanish sovereignty and wanting to stop an American incursion into Florida. Whereas John Quincy Adams, who becomes Jackson's great rival and great opponent of slavery, right? That's Mr. Adams' last crusade, as we now know it, was his conversion to abolitionism. And in fact, his condemnation of the Second Seminole War was Jackson's great defender, and he was Secretary of State at the time.
Yeah, so Jackson, it has to be remembered, he got his start in the military during the Creek War in 1813. Before that, you know, he was elected to, you know, state senate, judgeships, all these different things. And then he got his start in the Creek War. And then he became a major general in the Volunteer Army, which the Volunteer Army at the time was separate from the U.S. Army. And, you know, of course, he defeated the British in New Orleans, defeated them in Pensacola. And then he decides that he wants to go ahead and do an expedition to conquer Florida. Around 1817. And the professional military is very jealous of Jackson because he was essentially the hero of 1812. And a lot of people dispute the validity the scope of his victory in New Orleans. And a lot of people are kind of enraged at the fact that he conquered Pensacola and then just sort of abandoned it. So, you know, they didn't really trust him. The people that were, of a certain pedigree, they didn't like him. They didn't trust him. They thought he was crazy. There is a reputation that people have where they just assume that people were okay with Indians being killed by the U.S. military back in the 1820s or 1810s. Let me just, dissolve you of that myth right now. They were not. There were a lot of people that were frustrated in government and sickened by the Butcher's Bill every single time Andrew Jackson came back from a war. The Creek War, more Native Americans were killed in one day, and it was by Andrew Jackson, than at any other point in American history. And there was a lot of protest in Congress. Now, what you alluded to is the great friggin' irony in all of this is that the last person you would expect to be a champion of Andrew Jackson was the new Secretary of State for Monroe, John Quincy Adams. And every single time he would get involved in one of these campaigns, a small little diplomatic incident would break out where, you know, Andrew Jackson essentially murders some British officers that surrendered themselves. You know, and everybody's asking for his blood. And John Quincy Adams whispers something in, you know, Monroe's ear. And Andrew Jackson gets elevated. And I think, I don't think Andrew Jackson deserved this protection based on them liking him or admiring him. I think they saw him as a useful tool. I think Monroe and John Quincy Adams were tired of waiting for Florida. I think they wanted the entire Eastern Seaboard, and they realized that they were going to get it by having somebody like Andrew Jackson to let him loose and let him sweep across Florida. And I think it was a calculated move on their part. They knew his background. These were not foolish men. They knew what they were getting themselves into. They knew that it was going to get bloody and violent, and they went along with it because at the end of the day, they wanted this territory. They wanted it sealed up. They wanted it done and settled. We had been, us and Spain had been dancing around one another for decades now. And so they approved it, and he began his expedition in 1818. And he wreaked havoc. Pure and simple. You know, they never really had a chance. And he was asked a few times to be governor of Florida. He declined it twice. But what ended up happening was he basically agreed to be commissioner of the United States of Florida, which was also governor of the territories, but they had to create a new position for him. And basically, he, with an iron fist, managed to settle the Seminoles and the Spaniards, and he did it in record time, and his appointment... he only agreed to do it if the appointment orders were delivered ambiguously to him by James Monroe, basically to make sure that he had maximum coverage over any fallout for his methods. And John Quincy Adams went to great lengths to protect Jackson. Following his execution of two British citizens, not military, but citizens, at St. Mark's, there were calls for Jackson to be arrested. There was one famous cabinet position in the Monroe White House cabinet meeting where that was topic number one. Were we going to arrest him? Were we going to put him on trial? And he was saved by Adam.
Yeah, the irony of this is just unbelievable when you think about American history. and what happened between Adams and Jackson. Anyway, we will be back next week with more of our series on Andrew Jackson stealing Florida.